Down with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 11th episode of Robots. In today's show, we'll be looking at how one can develop walking and jumping robots at the millimeter scale. Our initiator, Professor Sarah Bergbreiter from the University of Maryland, speaks with Sabine about her minuscule robots and the challenges in downscaling. I'm sure you've never imagined a micro rubber band for jumping robots.
Adam then interviews Aaron Hoover from Ron Fearing's lab at UC Berkeley on his fully autonomous hexapod, which is smaller than a penny. Finally, to wrap up the show, we'll be hearing the third quarter of Jack Graham's Selkie story. So, Christine, what's the latest news in robotics?
Thanks, Sabine. A new robotic instrument has allowed surgeons to operate on a beating heart. The device, developed by researchers from Harvard University and Children's Hospital Boston, uses 3D ultrasound images to predict the heart's motion 70 to 100 milliseconds in advance, and then compensates the heart's motion by moving surgical tools in concert. Tests of the new robotic device to perform mitral valve surgery on a pig have now confirmed its effectiveness. The instrument has the potential to increase the safety of the 50,000 mitral valve surgeries performed in the U.S. per year by avoiding the risks of bypass surgery. It may also lead to shorter recovery times and would allow the surgeon to get instant feedback on the effectiveness of the procedure. Researchers at Georgia Tech and Duke University have created a wirelessly powered robot swarm. Their demo robot swarm consists of 5 robots performing a line-following task, each consuming 200 milliwatts. The fundamental design looks quite straightforward, relying on a robot arena surface equipped with a transmit coil and robots with a receiving coil positioned between the wheelbase close to the ground. A circulating current in the transmit coil generates a magnetic flux, which transfers power to the robots via inductive coupling. The technology is great news for people working with swarms of dozens or hundreds of robots, which currently require labor's connection and deconnection to charging stations. Details of the setup used, including a detailed description and circuit diagrams, are available online. Finally, Kazu Terasaki, a Japanese software engineer working in the Silicon Valley area, has created a walking iPhone robot. Using 2 servo motors in combination with small metal paddles, the robot can raise itself and shuffle its feet. Unfortunately, the current prototype can hardly be called useful. However, Terasaki is already on his way to pursue a wider goal, developing a kit of robot legs that you can attach to absolutely anything. Details and videos of the novel robotic instrument for heart surgery, the wirelessly powered robot swarm, and the walking iPhone can be found on our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Sarah Bergbreiter spent her PhD making a walking and then a jumping silicon-based milli robot with all power and control on board. Having spent hours at a time in a clean room to carve out her robots, she is now looking towards novel fabrication techniques which would allow her to make large numbers of robots for sensor network applications. As professor of the Microrobotics Lab at the University of Maryland, she's been investigating the challenges that occur when scaling down robots, such as power, actuation, integration, and mobility.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to have you here on Robots.
Thank you very much.
Can you present yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Sarah Bergbreiter. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Maryland in mechanical engineering and the Institute for Systems Research.
You've been working on autonomous walking and jumping micro-robots for sensor network applications for quite some time now. Can you tell us about the projects you've been working on in the past?
Sure. I've worked on, when I first started in graduate school, I started working on a more sensor network type application. I started at the University of California, Berkeley, kind of at the same time that sensor networks was really starting to explode on the scene, and people were building this neat hardware with microcontrollers and radios built in. And so the question for me was, can I take this, you know, neat hardware and the kind of software structure that people were building as well and turn that into a mobile robot application? And so that was the genesis of the CopSpots, which are commercial off-the-shelf mobile robots. And so we used off-the-shelf hardware, just toy RC cars that we could buy, the off-the-shelf sensor network hardware, and put it together to make mobile robots and mobile sensor networks. And the idea behind that was that it was a larger scale version of what we might be able to make on the micro scale. So millimeter-sized robots that can't necessarily use a lot of sensing and computation power in order to move around and do interesting things in their environment.
So maybe briefly, what's a sensor network?
Ah, good question. So a sensor network, the idea is that you have a lot of sensor nodes kind of scattered throughout a space. So you could sense chemical sensing for environmental pollution or something like that, or be able to sense people walking through your network. But sensors distributed in space, and you end up getting a lot of advantages if those sensors can move as well.
So you were talking about milli microscale robots before. Why did you want to go smaller?
That's a good question as well. My interest in small is basically I thought it was really neat. I thought it would be a really fun project, and there are a lot of really interesting challenges if you're trying to put actuators together with sensors, together with computation, together with communication and power, all in kind of this millimeter-sized package. I thought it was just fascinating at the time.
And I heard a really funny anecdote about someone else who was deploying sensors who maybe were not at that microscale in
exactly.
An environment where they were not wanted.
So one of the first sensor network deployments was on an island off the coast of Maine in the U.S. called Great Duck Island. And these were sensor nodes that were maybe about 5 centimeters by 2.5 centimeters. And they had little plastic antennas hanging off of them, and they were supposed to be monitoring these birds on the island that live in these burrows. And it turns out the rabbits on the island really liked the taste of the plastic antennas and chewed them all off. And the birds didn't much like the sensor nodes in their burrows, so they kind of covered them up with dirt. So one of the interesting things, if you can shrink things down so that they don't, you know, aren't obvious to the animals in the environment that you're trying to sense, you can do a lot of interesting things.
There are only a handful of micro-robots today. Can you give us an overview of what exists?
Sure. There are a lot that are kind of on the centimeter cubed scale. So there's, back in the early 90s, Seiko made the Mansur robot. There've been a couple things out of Sandia National Labs. One of the first robots that actually walked was by Ebifors, and that was a thermally actuated robot, which means that it used actuators that require heat to move. So it wasn't necessarily efficient. It still needed to be tethered to a power supply of some sort, but it was able to walk. In Berkeley, what I previously worked on was a walking robot that ended up being able to do autonomous push-ups. So it carried its power supply and its controller on board, but it wasn't actually able to walk very far. My PhD work was in jumping robots in order trying to get these millimeter-sized robots to jump. And then there's been some nanobots that came out of Dartmouth, Bruce Donald's group, and now at Duke. And these are maybe a couple hundred microns on a side and move over a special surface that provides power and control for the robot. But there's also, I'd like to interject that the genesis, the idea for these micro-robots kind of came around in the early 90s as well, as MEMS, which is micro-electromechanical systems, was finally kind of bursting on the scene. And the idea that you could put actuators and sensors and microcontrollers all in small amounts of silicon was very exciting to people. And so I think probably the first mention of micro-robots was Anita Flynn published a paper called Gnat Robots, the idea that you'd have these gnat-sized robots flying around.
Let's look a little at the robots you created, so the walking and the jumping one. What do these robots look like? What can they do?
So the walking robot, this was primarily done by Seth Holler and Anita Flynn, but it had two kind of L-shaped legs that would pull the robot along, essentially dragging its butt behind it. And that robot used electrostatic motors, which are just efficient motors, essentially. And like I said earlier, also carried solar cells for power and a microcontroller. And then what I worked on previously as well was a jumping robot. And the idea behind that was that this walking robot maybe couldn't go over, you know, arbitrary surfaces or different surfaces that you might want your robot to move on. And so a jumping robot basically contained a leg with a motor attached with essentially a micro rubber band. And the motor would stretch the micro rubber band and then release the leg a lot like a pogo stick in order to jump.
Do you think one mean of locomotion is better than the other in general?
I think one of the interesting things to look at these days in micro robots is actually how you would move around when you're this size. And at the moment, I think everything is very fabrication dependent. It turns out that jumping actually works very well for robots of this size because you can overcome all of the obstacles in the rough terrain around you. But it also turns out to be fairly efficient because it only uses one motor. It doesn't use a lot of additional kind of rotating surfaces, which are very difficult to build on this scale. The walking potentially can get a lot better than it's been in the past, but right now it's not there yet.
So I'm wondering, how do you currently build a micro robot?
It's a good question. A lot of people ask that. So it's not your traditional go to the local store and buy some motors and slap them together. So a lot of these things are done in clean room environments where you actually start with a silicon wafer and you use the same processes that you use to make integrated circuits or computer chips, but you make mechanical structures instead. And so a lot of that is you start with your silicon wafer, you can deposit a certain layer on it, etch it in a particular pattern, deposit another layer, etch it in a particular pattern, and you build things up from there. You can make hinges in this, you can make sliding surfaces, you can make motors, you can make all sorts of things using these processes.
What, in your opinion, are the main challenges in making these robots?
So I think one of the, I'd really divide it into five, maybe six challenges. I think the first that we talked about already is mobility, is how you actually move on this scale. Insects do it very well, but robots are really lagging behind, even at larger scales. Even when you're talking about bigger 10 centimeters or greater robots, they have a hard time moving through their environment. So I think mobility is really a challenge. I think also actuators and trying to get motors that are high force density and yet a lot of displacement or high power density depending on your robot is another huge challenge. And actually the walking robot that we worked on previously was limited by its actuators. That's the reason it wasn't able to walk forward and was only able to do push-ups. I think another challenge is the mechanisms. Like I mentioned previously, you can't very easily make hinged mechanisms or flexures quite like you can on large-scale robots. You need to actually have specific fabrication processes where you can make these interesting mechanisms. And I think there's a lot of progress in that area, but it's still lacking. Power is another big issue. If you're carrying your power supply with you, whether it's a battery or solar cells, you need that power to be able to integrate with whatever actuators you're using, whichever controller you're using, and you need to carry enough power. And then I'd say the final challenge is in integration and control and adding all of these disparate pieces together, being able to take a controller made in one technology and combine it to motors and legs made in another technology, or maybe even legs in a third technology, and being able to add all of these things together and do it in a robust way.
I think you have a good idea of how you want to start solving these challenges. Is there sort of a one-fit answer or the direction where you want to go now?
It's a good question. I'd say my overall goal is the end point that I would like to reach are kind of these networks of very small robots running around that can talk to each other. I don't think there's a single path to that goal. But what I'm starting with right now are some new, I think, very interesting fabrication techniques that it's very easy to kind of prototype these micro-robots and be able to test ideas without having to go into a clean room environment and do that.
Can you give us an idea of how that works? It's not too complicated.
Sure. It's the idea is that you would have polymers that you can pattern lithographically, which means that you shine light through a mask that you print on a transparency, for example, and pattern different structures. But you can use different polymers with different material properties. So you might have a very rigid epoxy-like polymer combined with a more silicone rubbery-like polymer. And you can try all of these different mechanisms just by using different polymers in this kind of same fabrication process that you'd use in the clean room, but you don't have to go into the clean room to etch these polymers.
So do you see yourself maybe building the same jumping robot that you build, but with this new technique? Yeah?
Oh, I totally see that. I think one of the interesting things with this is that it will be able to allow us to test our ideas very quickly first before actually going into the clean room and making an autonomous robot. Maybe we won't be able to do with this process, but at least a tethered robot to, you know, make sure it jumps, see how it recovers, and see if we can get it to jump again.
So in the future, once you finally manage to solve all these problems, how do you see your typical scenario? I mean, will you have a bunch of these and they'll jump around and sort of disperse in the environment? What's your scenario?
I think there are a couple interesting scenarios for these robots. At the beginning, we were talking about sensor networks. And I think the idea of having sensors, even if they're very tiny sensors that can move around through the environment or maybe even disappear into the environment when you're done, but have a lot of them that can provide good coverage of this environment will be really interesting to a lot of people. I think one of the other things that we didn't mention, though, is that I see the technologies themselves that go into these robots going into their own separate directions. I think actuators, the motors that we build for the micro-robots could be very interesting for implantable devices, or even cell phone camera zoom and autofocus use the same type actuators that we're building. And so there are a lot of commercial possibilities for these things as well.
Very often sensor networks are static. Why do you want to make the nodes mobile?
It's a good question. I think what people have been finding is that they'll deploy their network and it takes a lot of time to deploy the network, and then they're not in the area that something interesting is happening. So you can either make things mobile in order to spread out your network in the first place. So you start from one central area and then your network hops around to spread out. But once your network is spread out, you could also, if something interesting is happening in one area, like an animal is foraging around, you could hop over to that area in order to find out more information about what's going on in that area and get essentially a higher resolution on your sensors.
And to actually get an application robot which is ready to go outside, do you think it'll take years, decades?
That's a good question. We always like to be optimistic, so I'm going to go to the 10-year time frame.
Thanks, Sarah, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you very much.
Instead of making Millie robots that jump, Aaron Hoover from the University of California at Berkeley has been trying to make them crawl. In his last few years of research, he's developed a six-legged robot using rapid prototyping techniques that allow him to print and fold his robot in the matter of hours. Let's hear about the latest bugs coming out of California.
Hi, how are you doing, Aaron? Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Can you introduce yourselves to our listeners? Tell us what you do.
Sure. So my name is Aaron Hoover, and I work in the Biomimetic Millie Systems Lab at University of California, Berkeley. I'm a fifth-year PhD student, and I work on small-scale, what we call Millie robots. So these are robots with sizes on the order, or sort of masses on the order of 100 milligrams up to a few grams, 5 grams, maybe even 10 grams, and characteristic dimensions of millimeters. In some cases, feature sizes of 100 or 200 microns, as high as, 1 or 2 centimeters. So.
Okay. We talked to Sarah Bergreiter a couple days ago, and we asked her why, and she said she finds it fascinating.
Why do you want to do small robots and why not do bigger ones?
There are a lot of different answers, actually, that I can give to that. It's actually really, I find it a bit easier to work with small robots. The requirements for fabrication and integration they're just much less than you would see if you were working with something like a 10-kilogram robot or a humanoid or something like that. Typically, when you see humanoid research, most people are buying platforms off the shelf, right? They're not building those platforms themselves, and there's a reason for that. Those are tricky platforms to work with, partly because of their size and also because of integration. So in some ways, you know, it's because it's easy, but I also think that...
You think it's easy to make small robots?
I wouldn't say that it's easy to make small robots, but... the fabrication processes that we use in our lab enable us to make small robots in an easy, what I think is probably one of the easiest ways, for example, compared to, you know, some of these Swiss watchmakers here in Switzerland who, you know, have generations of experience learning how to machine gears and fit them together and integrate them into a watch. You know, it took me a couple years to learn how to use composites and compliant mechanisms to assemble a robotic structure in our lab. So that's one reason. And also, if you're working with small robots, the resources that you need are not that great. You can do it relatively cheaply. From a materials standpoint, you're using fewer materials. Electronics are generally very cheap. And overall, the package winds up being very inexpensive in the end. That is, if you exclude the labor required to do the design and assembly. So,
of course. Yeah. Does it give you an advantage to have a cockroach-sized robot as opposed to a bigger one? What application?
I think you have to really look at scale, and I think that I wouldn't necessarily say that small robots are somehow better than large robots, or even that milli robots are better than micro robots, or anything along those lines. You have to really look at applications, and... But I think when you combine the relatively low cost of small robots with relatively high mobility, for example, with an indoor flyer like the MFI that we've worked on at Berkeley and that Rob Wood has worked on at Harvard, when you combine that level of mobility with the level of mobility that you could get from a legged robot that can run for even just 10 minutes, let's say, you can see some pretty interesting applications in terms of, you know, search and rescue, or I know one of Sarah's favorite applications, which I also think is really neat, is some type of environmental monitoring where these robots have a relatively low impact on the environment where you deploy them because they are so small. You could do distributed sensing networks in sort of hazardous areas or areas where you wanted to monitor the health of the environment. I think that those are neat applications as well.
Just as a side comment about that, actually, I was thinking about monitoring with all these small robots, but when you say you're actually polluting the environment with all the robots, I mean, think about it. If you put all these milli-scale robots, you put thousands of them out there and you deploy them, you're probably not going to get most of them back.
Right, absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity to integrate this area of small robotics with sort of green manufacturing, with using, there are, for example, polymers that are made from organic materials like corn or something that you could actually integrate into your robot. There are even people working on organic conductive inks that you can make, for example, printed circuit boards with. And so there are ways, I think, to combine the technological innovation that's happening behind or around green manufacturing or green engineering with these mobile robots and potentially open up a really nice space where you almost have I would hesitate to say disposable, but degradable robots. Exactly. You know, and depending on your application, maybe that's all you need, you know? So I think that could be an interesting space as well.
Okay. Let's talk about your robot a little bit more. So you're working on legged robots as opposed to Sarah, who prefers the jumping ones.
Sure.
Why legged, and what advantage do you see? Or maybe tell us about your robot to start with.
Sure. So my robot is called the Roach, and that stands for Robotic Autonomous Crawling Hexapod.
Did you think of the acronym first?
In fact, I have to give credit for the acronym to a lab mate of mine, Brian Schubert, who... you know, we built the robot, and then, you know, the day that we wrote the paper, or the day that we started writing the paper, we decided we need a clever name so that when people refer to this robot, it is something that people remember. And Brian came up with something. You know, we sort of listed all the terms that we possibly could on the whiteboard that had to do with how the robot functioned, and Brian came up with the name. But so it's a 2.5 gram milli robot that's got 6 legs, and it, even though it has 6 legs, it only has 2 degrees of freedom. So, that was a challenge in and of itself to design the kinematics in such a way that we could have a 6-legged robot, which is nice because with 6 legs, when you actuate 3 legs at a time, essentially you form this triangle, right? And as long as your center of mass is over that triangle, within that triangle, you're stable. And so it makes for walking very easy, essentially, because it's statically stable. But so we use those 2 degrees of freedom, and we actuate them with shape memory alloy wires, which are just wires that contract when you heat them. And then we have some onboard control with small electronics to essentially control those shape memory alloy wires and do things like walk straight or steer, for example.
And have you managed to do this already?
Yes, we have. We have video proof online. So we've managed to achieve walking up to 1 body length a second, which is about 25 or 30 millimeters a second. So, which is nowhere close to how fast a cockroach can run at its fastest. So, you know, it's always humbling to me to observe the biological systems that can be inspiring for these robots, and realize how far we are from actually achieving parity with those systems.
Do you think we'll get there soon?
I don't know that we necessarily want to copy the systems, but I think that there's a strong effort to understand the systems better and distill from those systems the principles that would enable you to build more effective man-made systems. And I think that's why it's important to think about bio-inspiration rather than, for example, biomimicry, where you just set out to try and build a copy of an organism. It's really important to understand the underlying principles. And I think we are getting better at doing that, at looking at the systems, distilling the principles, and then figuring out how to recreate the fundamental sort of modes that create interesting behavior in those systems.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're interested in maybe not just learning principles from biology to build robots, but also to close the loop and learn some lessons from robots and apply that to our understanding of cockroaches. Do you know, or cockroaches or other legged insects, do you know of any examples of things you might have learned with your robot that could be applicable to?
So far, actually, I think really the purpose of this robot was to create a platform, to show that we could create a small platform where that might help us to study the biological system. So as of now, we haven't actually been able to do any experiments where we use the robot to understand a biological system yet. And I think that's sort of one of a series of logical next steps would be to ask some fundamental questions about, for example, cockroaches, or even there are actually also other systems that you could study with robots of the size that Roach is. And it's important, I think, to ask the right questions about those systems and frame them in such a way that you could be able to potentially get an answer using a sort of robot. And I think the neat thing about that is that the robot enables you to tightly control certain parameters and eliminate other parameters that might not be important, or might actually be important, but just eliminate them so that you can simplify experiments. And I mean, I've worked actually with organisms myself, and it's really challenging to get them to do what you want them to do. You'd be surprised how smart cockroaches are. How quickly they learn, and how quickly they don't want to do exactly what you want them to do. So,
what's your favorite type of cockroach?
My favorite cockroach has to be, it's odd, I think, to have a favorite cockroach, but I'd have to say there's a cockroach, Periplaneta americana, that can run, which is the American cockroach, and it's not the cockroach that you see in your kitchen, because this cockroach is capable of running at speeds in excess of 50 body lengths a second.
Oh, yeah.
And it can, in fact, run so fast that it can rear up on its hind legs as it's running and go into a bipedal mode. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, that's pretty unbelievable. And just on the basis of that extraordinary performance, that's sort of my my favorite cockroach. It's also a very good climber as well. So
I guess you're familiar with Jorge Cham's work at Stanford?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Also with slightly larger platforms, but trying to copy the cockroach gait. How does that relate to your work, and how is it applicable and useful to what you do?
I think Jorge's work is really interesting and really good, and I think it's sort of directly actually applicable to our work in the sense that they're using compliant mechanisms the same, in a similar way that we're using compliant mechanisms, even though they're running at a much larger mass and overall dimension. But they sort of did a nice experiment where they designed this robot to have similar dynamics to a cockroach, and then ran it on a force platform, and then verified that given those force traces and that behavior, that they were approaching something that looked like a dynamic gait that you would see in a cockroach. And I think that that's informed my research quite a bit now. And I think about how can we do similar experiments with our robot on, now granted at 2.5 grams, you need a much more sensitive force platform and, you need to use some different equipment, but I think that that's really interesting. And so, I would say it's sort of a precursor to our work in a lot of ways, using similar technologies, just at a much larger scale. And
maybe as a last question, kind of the same question we always ask, but let's look at maybe some future directions, because you now have a walking 2.5 gram robot, you can turn left and right. What's your challenge right now?
Our challenge right now is actually, I think, to get into more dynamic gaits, essentially. I think that's where the really interesting behavior in legged locomotion begins to take place. And if you look, dynamic gaits depend a lot on the passive mechanics of the structure that you're working with, and specifically like the stiffness of the legs. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at how can we get more dynamic actuation, and how can we, for example, use stiffness control in the legs to do dynamic steering now, as opposed to the sort of quasi-static steering that we're doing currently. So trying to keep the platform size still fairly small, definitely under 10 grams. I'd like to have it under 5 grams, but sensing may actually put us over that. Yeah. And trying to incorporate some more, more explicitly incorporate dynamics into running, actually. So.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot, Aaron. All the best.
And now to finish off today's episode, let's sit back and chill for the third quarter of Jack Graham's Selkie story.
The stranger from the kayak looked at Mangan gravely. So, are you the jackass responsible for the robot seals?
I am proud to be that jackass, Mangan said. And you might try being civil first.
She was wearing specs, so he sent his profile. She skimmed it quickly while he read hers. Sylvia Ochoa, researcher, UN Marine Fisheries Agency.
My sharks are eating your robots, Mr. Mangan.
Great white sharks? I didn't think we had those here.
No, tiger sharks. They've moved north as the waters warmed. She looked at Cato, who was still eyeing her suspiciously. Seals are their natural prey. Speaking of which, what's with the sea lion?
He's a consultant. I modeled the first two versions on him.
Mangan had lost two Selkies in early testing, both from the 2 series modeled on Cato. Mangan tried to recover them, concerned about the chemicals in the batteries seeping out, but eventually gave up. Ochoa explained her work. A species impact study looking at the effects of the garbage in the North Pacific gyre on this new northerly population of tiger sharks. Mangan interrupted occasionally with questions, at which she appeared to warm from her initial hostility. She had now found 2 tiger shark carcasses with Selkies in their bellies.
So, how fast do your sharks swim, then?
Slowly most of the time, but when they rush their prey, they can reach almost 10 meters per second.
Is that all?
He was already brainstorming.
I ought to be able to fix that.
By getting them out of the water, I hope.
Nah, it's just a matter of giving them swarm intelligence.
He had in mind a paper he'd read about evasion patterns among schooling fish. There's a lot of work on that subject. If I'd known there were great bloody sharks out here... You're joking. Who's funding you? The Californians. I'm not just doing this for crack. There's a great mess of rubbish to be cleaned up here. She raised an eyebrow. Really? Sorry, but your solution seems over-designed. It's hard to believe you got funding. I can be quite persuasive. Sure you don't want a beer? She accepted it. Thanks, but don't get any ideas. You wound me. Throw Cato a fish. He's still not sure about you. He offered her the bucket, and she tossed a herring to the sea lion. How long are you out here?
Another 2 months.
Good. You can watch the test of my 4 series, then. I think I can shark-proof them in about 3 weeks.
It would take some work, though.
And that wraps up today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Our next show will air in 2 weeks, but in the meantime, stay in touch through our forum for the latest news and hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Shrink Down with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.